Channel presents Mormon Identities, a program about real Latter-day Saints as they live the restored gospel of Jesus Christ in the world today. The gospel shapes our identity and serves as a common thread in the other factors that help define who we are. We will explore these factors and discuss topics about our community and culture, scripture and doctrine, and life experiences and challenges. Mormon Identities, here on the Mormon Channel.
Welcome to Mormon Identities, a program about Latter-day Saints, who we are, what we believe, and how we live. I'm your host, Eric Huntsman, and for today's program, we have a community and culture episode, Soviet citizen, Russian and Ukrainian nationals, Latter-day Saints. Our guests today are Vadim Oleskevich and Ksenia Adriyanova. Did I say that right? Let me introduce them. As our listeners know, this is a show about our identities, the different factors and pieces of our background that make us who we are. Vadim Oleskevich was born in 1959 in Kiev, in what was then the Soviet Union. His father is a military engineer and his mother taught physics. He graduated in 1976 from what we would call high school and entered the Kiev Polytechnic Institute. He was going to be an engineer, but in 1982 he changed his mind and entered the Kiev State University to begin his study of languages, philology. Is that correct?
Yes.
In 1992 he joined the church. He also began working for the Ukrainian Translation Office in Kiev. He participated in the Ukrainian translation of the scriptures, the triple combination, various lesson manuals, the temple ordinances, handbooks, and hymns. In 2008, he came to Provo with his family to resume his studies, this time at BYU. Ksenia Adriyanova is from Russia. She was born in a town called Ufa, not too far from the Ural Mountains, in 1983, to Peter and Lydia Adriyanova, Soviet geologist. She joined the church when she was 18, and in 2002 served a mission for the LDS Church. From 2004 to 2006, she attended the Ufa State Teaching University, but she has been employed since her mission with various church-associated entities, the Humanitarian Welfare Program, CES, for the Eastern European Office, etc. She came to the United States to complete her education, graduating from the LDS Business College with a degree in legal administration, and she plans ultimately to go to law school. We would like to do three different things in this half hour. We would like to talk to our guests, first of all, about their experiences growing up in what was then the Soviet Union. We then want to talk to them about their national heritages and how their now separate independent countries, Russia and Ukraine, have changed since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And then in the end, the last third of our program, we'd like to talk about their experiences, how they joined the church, but in particular how the church is viewed and what its prospects are in the former Soviet Union. Now, as many of us recall, in the late 1980s, then-President Mikhail Gorbachev tried to reform the Soviet system. A lot of Americans who never knew word one of Russian, except perhaps nyet and da, learned words like perestroika and glasnost. We knew that there were changes going on. Eventually, that led to a collapse of that system. But we would like to hear from both of you what it was like before that era. In the pre-Gorbachev era, what was the role of the state vis-a-vis families and individuals and religious life? Let's start with you, Ksenia.
Well, the state determined everything. Since I was 8 years old when the regime changed, I rely mostly on the memories of my family, of my parents. So, for example, with my mother, when she graduated from college with a degree in geology, she received an assignment from the government to go to a different city. She is originally from the Ukraine, but she was sent to Ufa, and against her will, basically. She did not want to go there, but she didn't have a say. Basically, they sent her, and that's where she started her life. She started her family there. But the government defined her life and her destiny. Also, it seems like very little depended on the individual. The state mostly determined a lot of things. Only, in my opinion, only exceptionally talented people were able to choose the destiny for themselves. But for ordinary people, the state had that determining role.
Okay, now, Vadim, you're somewhat older, so you have some more secure and strong memories
actually,
of that period,
I had a typical Soviet childhood. And I was born when the Orthodox phase of Soviet Union was already over. because Stalin died in 1953, and that was the beginning of dissolution of the Soviet mindset. I would call it pharisaic liberalization of mind, because people would still go to communist meetings, they would read communist newspapers, but deep inside, practically nobody believed.
So it was all outward performance, but inside they kept to themselves what they felt.
Yeah, actually, Soviet people in the 60s and 70s were super pharisaic, because they really didn't believe, and people who did believe that were considered strange.
Mm-hmm. Now, we were talking before this episode began, and you said there's this kind of threefold division, that people said one thing, they thought another thing, and they acted even a different way.
That's right. Sometimes that was called double moral, but in fact it was triple.
Mm-hmm. Now, despite some of the obvious problems that system had and the excesses of what some of us would say was the old communist system, there were some objectives that, at least on paper, seemed positive. What were some of the positive goals that the system claimed to be working for, and did it accomplish any of them, Ksenia?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the main goals that the government was working towards was justice, equality, unity.
Mm-hmm. Unity at all costs, of course.
Exactly. But. Absolutely. So I remember at that time, of course, I was a little girl. We were living in a common living, which was called общежитие, where a lot of people lived at the same place, basically sharing their kitchens, sharing everything. People didn't have a lot of things, but there was that feeling of unity, and there was the feeling of there was no jealousy, no mistrust. At least among the people that kind of work together or live together. So that's something I think, and my parents refer to that part of their lives as the happiest moments of their lives, because they made a lot of friends living there. There were no bad feelings towards the people that they lived among. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that was a positive thing. And
and probably has been lost to a certain extent, hasn't it? As everyone's
that's
been working
right.
for
Absolutely.
Himself or herself.
Exactly.
Adin?
Yeah, now we have this feeling of estrangement. People are not as united as they used to be. And to mention a couple of positive things during the Soviet era was a pretty decent healthcare system. We didn't have the latest equipment, but we had medicines, and it was medicines
available to everybody.
Yeah, and treatment was free, mm-hmm. and hospitals were free, and they were not the best in the world. But now it's much more difficult. The level
right.
of service remains the same, but you have to buy everything
yourself,
including doctors.
Mm-hmm.
People actually have to bribe doctors to guarantee.
One of the things
treatment.
I thought about as Ksenia was talking about that feeling of unity, at least at the local level in neighborhoods and between families. You know, when I was growing up, we always were very careful in the LDS Church to distinguish between, you know, the law of consecration, the United Order, and communism. You know, and we made that differentiation very clear. But as you were speaking, I was thinking about what a Zion society is supposed to be. That we're one heart and one mind, and there's no poor among us. Now, the way that system tried to accomplish it didn't work
exactly.
and took away freedom and agency, but the impulse to want those things, I think.
Yeah, actually,
good.
The Soviet Zion followed the rule there were no rich men.
There you go.
That sort of equality.
Let me ask you about religion in the pre-Gorbachev era. I know traditionally that much of the Soviet Union was Eastern Orthodox. There were some Lutherans and Protestants, I guess, in the Baltics and, of course, Muslims in Central Asia. But communism was officially atheistic. I know there were different times, like during World War II or the Great Patriotic War, I think we called that, that the Russian Orthodox Church supported the motherland against the Germans. So maybe they were kind of tolerated a little bit more. But what was it like growing up? I mean, was your family religious at all, or did you know religious people?
No. My parents were atheists,
mm-hmm.
and I was grown up and brought up as an atheist. And paradoxically, that helped me to find the truth, because my field mm-hmm. was sterile.
That's
and
right.
Clean.
It's a blank
no
slate.
No old traditions, no ideas of, you know, irrational God.
Yeah.
When I found the church, that was obvious.
Okay, Ksenia, what about your family? Did they have any religious practices?
My parents, since they're scientists, they have their own beliefs. So God was never really part of my upbringing. But I think my grandparents, they've always tried to keep that faith, even though it wasn't perfect. They didn't know much about their church, the Orthodox Church, but they still tried to keep the Bible and the sacred images.
The icons.
Exactly, mm-hmm. The icons, absolutely. And also some manuals that I actually started reading, and that's how I got interested in the religion overall.
Right. I understand that particularly it was safe for grandmas, or babushkas, to go to church.
Absolutely.
And the people that were in the churches were these older ladies, but they were very devout, weren't mm-hmm. they?
Yeah, the same is true about my grandparents. They were also religious. Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk about the move from the Soviet Union to these independent countries. I mentioned at the beginning perestroika and glasnost. For our audience, glasnost, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is more of an attitude, a feeling of openness, hoping that people express themselves, moving towards freedom of speech, whereas perestroika was more of a structural, I guess, change, restructuring, right?
Restructuring, yes.
And that was probably mainly economic, wasn't it, to try to make the economy better and improve people's lives? Well, I guess there was political restructuring as well. What did that feel like when you heard, you know, who had been the chairman of the Soviet Communist Party, but later president of the Soviet Union, say these kind of things out loud? I mean, that must have been revolutionary.
That was very exciting, and that was a time of great hopes. Actually, I would call these several years one of the best years of mm-hmm. my life, because there was great hope that finally all this, you know, pharisaic, inefficient, dull, and mediocre system would be able to heal itself. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it was illusionary. It crumbled very soon.
My dad refers to glasnost as to the breath of fresh air. That's how he felt. I was two at that time, so I don't remember anything. Mm-hmm. But we discussed that in my family. My dad said that it was just he had hope, finally, that he was able to express his feelings. And also he was able to see that when the national or people's representatives got together, it was a broadcast live, and everybody
could see what they were talking about, how they were voting.
Absolutely. And at that time, they were trying very hard to cancel the sixth article of the Constitution that basically gave the party all of the rights.
Right, a commanding role in society. It was
absolutely
a way of kind of institutionalizing mm-hmm. it. Go ahead.
So when he heard that and when he saw that on TV, at first it was unbelievable that he was witnessing that. So it was just revolutionary.
In the United States and many Western European countries, nationalism is generally seen as a good thing. It's patriotism. But as we've seen in many areas throughout the world, unchecked nationalism can be very destructive. We see what happened in the former Yugoslavia, for instance, where age-old hatreds were kind of unleashed and people killed each other, and there was all this division. Nationalism began to assert itself very early in this period, didn't it?
We must understand that there are two kinds of nationalism. We can call it medically malignant and benign. Mm-hmm. Benign is the same as patriotism. You just love your nation. You want to serve it. Mm-hmm. But malignant nationalism offers to people simple answers to complicated questions like, you don't live well. I know who is guilty.
Someone else.
Your neighbors.
Right,
someone else.
Right.
And we talk about chauvinism. There's another term, jingoism, when you just hate the other.
And
mm-hmm.
sometimes politicians can exploit that. That, you know, rather than look at what they're not doing well, you look at what everyone else is doing wrong.
Now, Vadim, you came from Ukraine, and Ukraine has a very complicated history that many people don't know. It wasn't its own country for most of its history, and some of it that was under Austrian or Polish control.
That's
developed
right.
In one way, and that which is under Russian control went another way. And so when the nationalism started to assert itself, it actually divided Ukraine, didn't it? Because people in the West were very Ukrainian, but people in the East were either ethnically Russian or had been Russified, I guess we'd
say. That's right. That's right. Actually, my country does not have a, you know, settled tradition and mindset of self-administration. As you mentioned, Poles, Austrians, and Russians always dominated. And now it's a period of crisis, mm-hmm. mental crisis, not as much political as mental. It's the task of acquiring proper mentality of a responsible citizenry.
And to
still don't have it.
To enjoy being Ukrainian without
necessarily to be proud of that, yes.
persecuting others, because mm-hmm. Ukraine has a lot of minorities. Now,
Ksenia, Russia's an interesting situation, isn't it? Because great Russians or ethnic Russians had always dominated the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union. But with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, what was it, Christmas Day 1991? Does that sound right?
Right, mm-hmm. When President Gorbachev resigned.
A lot of ethnic Russians found themselves not in the Russian Federation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the term they use is near abroad. Is that what they call that?
Exactly, near abroad.
So
I think that for those Russians who found themselves in the near abroad, life became a little bit harder than for those who actually stayed in the state. But with the national, with the Russian nationalism within the country, I believe that it's very passive.
Mm-hmm.
We can see some negative appearances of nationalism. For example, a few months ago when we had the events on the Manezhnaya Ploshchad, where just a few ethnic groups got together and basically it led to the killing of a person. So we see that that proud nationalism does not really exist. I think nationalism comes when you're proud of what your government is doing, when you have assurance in the future. But I think right now a lot of Russians, they don't feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really support the government and the direction that they're taking.
I guess to go back to Vadim's characterization of nationalism being either benign or malignant,
mm-hmm.
I think the positive, non-hurtful nationalism is when it's not the government so much you're supporting as it is your heritage and your language and your culture and your family, when you're proud of your traditions and who you are. Once again, to stress for our audience, you know, Russians who used to dominate the Soviet Union, particularly I would say probably in the central Soviet republics or in the Baltic states,
mm-hmm.
you know, I know that the Baltic states were forcibly incorporated in the Soviet Union. This is Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. And I think particularly in Estonia and Latvia, the Latvians and Lithuanians were barely majorities in their countries. So there are lots of Russians in those countries, 30-40%,
mm-hmm. but they were forced to learn the new languages.
Exactly.
They were pushed out of jobs. So that was probably a source of a lot of tension, wasn't it?
Exactly. It was. I have a few friends that are from Latvia, and I've personally been there and to Estonia. It seems like in the street you don't really want to speak Russian
mm-hmm.
if you don't want to be treated in a bad way. And, of course, I understand the feelings of those people that live there, the Latvians and Estonians, but the Russian population there, they are having a hard time.
Let me ask you a question, since you're both living in the United States right now, with this experience with ethnic diversity and struggles. As you're in this country where, you know, the majority is still from certain ethnic groups and English speaking, and you watch us have debates about English as the official language and our Hispanic brothers and sisters are moving in or immigrants, what kind of take do you have on America's confronting these kind of ethnic differences? I mean, do you see it a little bit differently than perhaps I do when you see us arguing about what the official language should be and that kind of thing? Ksenia, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think we've seen that in our own country. So in the Ukraine or in Kazakhstan, we see that those fights and we understand those minorities because they do have the right to have their own language or to speak that language comfortably. I grew up in the Republic of Bashkortostan, so we had two state languages, Russian and Bashkirian. So all of the signs in the city were in both languages. So I and sometimes, for example, I wasn't very happy with what the Bashkirians did with their language, kind of pushing it
mm-hmm.
and imposing it on us. So I can kind of feel for both groups here in the States too.
We have a slightly different situation because we are basically all bilingual, and it's one thing Russian domination through, you know, Russian imperialism. And the other thing is Russian culture, literature,
mm-hmm.
art. And I don't think it's a demerit that I have two first languages.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel that. And Russia has great tradition in culture and literature. And
so it makes you as a Ukrainian better to know that.
Yeah. So the only proper way, as I see it, is to compete,
mm-hmm.
to create something Ukrainian national, rather than
tear down the Russian.
It's the same situation with English. English is a great language, and if you know English, you just open the gates to an ocean
mm-hmm.
of wonderful information. So why fight that? I don't understand that.
But for those of us who are English as our mother language, if we will learn other languages and become familiar with other cultures, that just enriches our lives, doesn't it?
That's right. I believe that the Hispanic people need to know English. That's for their own good. And it's much easier than studying Russian.
Now, this is actually a nice segue or bridge into our final topic, which is about the gospel, because the thing that I keep realizing again and again when I have some of these episodes is that regardless of how different our backgrounds are, if we can recognize that we're all children of God, that we're brothers and sisters, that we each have value, it makes it easier to not only accept the differences in other people, but to embrace them. And, you know, you don't need to be a religious person to have that point of view. I mean, out in the world, they call that humanism, valuing people. So let's talk about the LDS Church and how it helped you understand that about yourselves and about other people. Ksenia, very briefly, tell us about how you came in contact with the church. You said you had read some literature your grandparents had had or something that gave you religious ideas. But how did you encounter the LDS Church?
Exactly. At some point in my life, I realized that my church, and I was a member of the Orthodox Church, I was attending the church there. But at some point in my life, I realized that the answers that were that they were giving me, they were not enough. So
I love what you said. Not that they were always wrong. They weren't enough for
exactly.
you.
And there is so much good that the churches that church is teaching their people. But I had a problem with their doctrines. I didn't particularly understand them, even though I tried. So that's when I realized that I needed to search and to do some good research.
So you did your own searching and reading before you ever encountered a Latter-day Saint or Mormon missionaries, is that correct?
Exactly. So I searched different things. I searched different churches. For example, the Catholic Church, the Protestant churches, different Russian denominations. And that's when I remembered that I had previously gone to the Mormon English lessons. Mm. So, and I knew that they were a religion organization. So I went there and asked them what they thought about my questions and what they taught me.
Oh, we always love it when people come and ask us, what do you believe? We want to know where we came from. That's wonderful. What about you, Vadim? You said you were an atheist growing up.
That's right. And by the end of the 80s, I started to agree within myself that God existed. But the churches, mostly Protestants, which I tried to investigate, still didn't give me much satisfaction because that was a religion of mysticism and mist, actually. Mm-hmm.
So when you wanted something that made sense to you.
Yeah, I love rationalism. I love when I examine some ideas or some teaching, I would like to have a transparent 3D model, you know. And when I met the Mormon Church, here it is.
Yeah,
I understood everything, but that was not important, not the most important thing, because the most important thing was the spirit.
That's right, because you were. It's not just an intellectual decision; it's a conversion.
Intellectually, it's blameless, but it's not enough to stay in it. Because if you don't have the spirit, that's just the plot of a wonderful science fiction.
How did your friends and family react when you joined the church, Ksenia?
My family did not like that. I actually didn't tell them that I was going to be baptized. I knew it was. I will have problems. My dad thinks that your religion comes with your nationality, even though he is not a believer. But since I am Russian,
then you should be Orthodox.
Exactly. So they're still don't
not
like
happy.
Not happy about me being a member. But things are getting better.
Yeah, actually, none of my relatives or friends were worried because they knew my jumping character, they were sure that it's just for a couple of months.
You'll jump to something else.
Yeah. Well, they were wrong.
Yeah, I think it's interesting what Ksenia said, though. I think a lot of post-Soviet, even politicians, right, some of them like President Yeltsin and I think President Putin, they've all been baptized. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's necessarily a sign of their belief, but it's an identification with the culture
it's
and
a
the
culture.
History.
Exactly.
Right. Now, what is the attitude towards Ukrainians and Russians towards the church? I mean, is the church still looked at with some suspicion? Is it an American thing? Is it a weird religion? Vadim, let's start
well,
with you.
This attitude actually wears out, mostly because of the temple. If you have this beautiful, wonderful structure.
You're talking about the Kiev temple that's just been dedicated.
Yes, you cannot be called a sect. That's our mentality.
Okay, so when it was a small group of Americans wearing white shirts and ties riding bicycles around, it was a weird sect.
That's a vicious sect,
of course. But now we have an important building, and the government leaders came out to the open house, and that's kind of recognizing they're here to stay, I guess, in Ukraine at least.
Yes, plus we have earned some reputation as
good citizens, moral people.
Moral people.
What about in Russia, Ksenia?
I think it's a little bit different in Russia. On my mission, we had a lot of opposition from the people that we talked to. They were afraid of talking to us because they think that all foreign is bad.
Now that's leftover probably from the Soviet days, right?
Absolutely. I completely agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked a lot about the different aspects of your identity and how being Soviets and then Russians and Ukrainians makes you who you are and how we're different and somewhat how we're the same. Let's talk for a moment as people, even Latter-day Saints, coming to the United States to work or to go to school. You're different from other people. You've got a different history and this is your second or third language. How did coming to the United States but being able to go to church with other Mormons. How did that help you realize you did have a place that you did fit in? I guess I'd like to end this episode by talking about what unites us. Ksenia.
Mm-hmm. For me, it wasn't a big adjustment when I moved here because I saw my brothers and sisters in the faith and it made all the difference. I don't think that I'm different, actually, in the Mormon world, and especially here in Utah. It was some cultural things were, of course, different, but I felt I was accepted because I have a lot more in common with the LDS Americans than with some non-LDS Russians.
Mm. Interesting. Vadim?
Yeah, actually, if I were to go to another place in America, that probably could be different.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you know, this double citizenship. I'm a Ukrainian, but I also belong to the
Kingdom of God.
Latter-day Israel.
That's right. So,
yes.
That's right.
And so I felt accepted, yes. And not for a second, I felt myself a stranger. I was accepted, and that was so obvious that not a single doubt would ever enter my head.
You know, that's wonderful, and this is going to have to be a paraphrase, but Peter and Paul, both in the New Testament, say you are no longer strangers and aliens, but your fellow citizens
exactly.
And household of faith. And I think that's a wonderful thing, that we can keep our background and our history and our culture, but we really do have more that unites us. First of all, we're human beings. Second, we're sons and daughters of God, and we're members of the church together.
Yeah, we have our own church national culture.
Right, right.
And ideally, it should be, as you were saying, Vadim, earlier about how being a Ukrainian but appreciating Russian literature, or as you were saying earlier, Ksenia, that you had some basic beliefs from the Orthodox Church, but you brought in more. George Albert Smith used to love to say, when you come into the LDS fold, bring what truth you have and we'll give you more.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
I think it's important for those of us, particularly someone like me who grew up in the LDS Church and comes from Utah several generations, that we have that open mind. We hold fast to what's true, but we look at people all over the world and we be excited they're coming to the church. Not just the church is getting bigger and our numbers are getting bigger, but that the richness that they're bringing can bless our lives as well.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you, audience, for joining us for this episode of Mormon Identities, where we've been talking to our friends from Russia and Ukraine about their experiences in the Soviet Union, in their newly independent countries, and most of all, as members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Once again, thank you for joining us for this episode of Mormon Identities. I'm Eric Huntsman, reminding you to remember who we are as Latter-day Saints, what we believe, and how we live. Until next time, remember that today is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it.
You've been listening to Mormon Identities here on the Mormon Channel. To download or podcast this episode, please click on our homepage, radio.lds.org.